my summer research conducted under the supervision of Mark and Claudia. So I'm going to introduce a large class of models that have a hope of solving the cosmological constant problem, and I'll say a few things about them. I'll discuss how we can make predictions, do so, and then compare these predictions to observation. So to start, what's the cosmological constant problem? Well, first of all, it's a mouthful, so I'll abbreviate it as CCP from now on. So we know that the universe is undergoing a period of accelerated expansion, the onset of which is rather recent by cosmological standards. So a cosmological constant, that is a component of the universe with negative pressure and constant energy density, accounts for the observations rather well. So in principle, there could be many contributions to the cosmological constant. But if we try to calculate the contribution to the energy density from one possible source, namely the vacuum fluctuations of quantum fields, we get a result 120 orders of magnitude greater than the observed result of about 10 to the negative 29 grams per cubic centimeter. So, what are some possible resolutions? Well, instead of asking why is the vacuum energy so small, as is usually done, we can ask, why does the vacuum energy gravitate somewhere? Now, in the context of GR, these questions are equivalent. However, it may be possible to modify gravity in a way that certain components of the stress-energy tensor, namely those that manifest themselves on large scales, like the cosmological constant, gravitate differently. Thus, we'll be considering the so-called infrared modified theories of gravity, infrared referring to the fact that the equations of motion are modified at long wavelengths, which I'll make precise later. So in particular, we'll be interested in those models that can degravitate the vacuum, that is, allow an arbitrarily large cosmological constant to gravitate as weakly as necessary to fit the observed data. Now, all of these models use the same conceptual framework of GR, namely that stress energy creates space-time curvature, but they differ by modifying the underlying dynamics. Okay. Unfortunately, we don't really know what these models look like. Fortunately, it turns out we can say a lot about a general class of IR modified views of gravity without knowing anything about their specific bulk. So now, Weinberg showed some time ago that GR is the unique theory of gravity, obeying local Lorentz invariants with a massless spin to propagate like the graviton. And so any modification of gravity must necessarily modify the dynamics of the gravity. So we're going to be considering a broad class of models that satisfy these requirements. So our models, one, are self-consistent. No ghosts or anything like that. They admit the weak field linearized expansion on asymptotically flat backgrounds. And they modify gravity past some crossover scale, which we'll come up with. And now, Ghia Dvali showed that any models that satisfy these three conditions have the following properties. One, they have a massive or resonance graviton, in which the graviton is a continuum of massive states that carries three extra degrees of freedom. And these are two vectors and one scalar. They exhibit the critically important phenomena of strong coupling of the scalar degree of freedom. And they can be parameterized at the linear level with a single parameter will denote alpha, and alpha must go between 0 and 1. So I'll elaborate on these points, starting with the extra degrees of freedom. So the usual graviton has 2 degrees of freedom, which in the language of particle physics are called the helicity 2 modes. The additional vector degrees of freedom are helicity 1 modes, and the extra scalar degree of freedom is a helicity 0 mode. So if you're not familiar with the nomenclature, just take these as convenient names for the extra degrees of freedom. Now, we're going to see that all of the interesting features of these models really lie in that extra scalar degree of freedom, which we'll denote. By pi henceforth. And this is really the important feature of all these models. So, our starting point then is the weak field linearized expansion, which we take to be a generalization of Pauli Thiert's massive gravity. Now in this expression, this is your linearized Einstein tensor. M squared of box is a mass function, which we'll choose in a second. And T is your stress energy tensor. Of course, H just represents small metric fluctuations for, away from flat space and corresponds to the graviton. So this is a sensible place to start modifying gravity, as Pauli and Thiert show that with this being the graviton mass, this is the only self-consistent theory of massive gravity at the linear level. The nonlinear completion, which is unknown. So we want the dynamics to be modified for past some crossover scale. So we're going to choose a mass function of this form. And then there's higher order. There can be higher order terms. This is enough at the linear level. Okay, and box, of course, is the down version. So you may be wondering what box to the alpha means. So I'll tell you. This really only makes sense, or we can really only take this seriously in Fourier space, whereby box to the alpha really gets taken to wave number to the 2 alpha. So then to see how this represents an IR modification of gravity, we see if we take the ratio of the mass term to the leading Einstein term with this substitution, we find that the ratio is this. So we see that for distances much greater than the crossover scale, corresponding to wave numbers much less than the inverse crossover scale, the denominator is small, so the ratio is large, hence the mass term dominates over the Einstein term. So this is really what this is the sense in which we mean infrared modification, as small wave number corresponds to very long wave.
Can I ask a question? Does these vector and scalar modes, can you point, presumably they're components of H mu in some sense, right?
Yeah.
So the deviations from being traceless and transverse, is that right? H is, little h there with no indices, is the trace of H?
That's
obviously related to chi, presumably?
Yeah, right now, so this H is the full graviton with extra degrees of freedom and all.
Right.
We'll see later on when we get to actually making calculations, we can actually decouple the usual degrees of freedom from the extra degrees of freedom, and then we'll see how they come out. Okay, so just returning to the degrees of freedom then. Extra degrees of freedom posed a problem right from the beginning when massive gravity was first considered, because if we compare if we compare the one graviton exchange amplitude between two conserved sources, like the Earth and the Moon, say, for GR, here it's massive gravity. We see that even in the limit that the graviton mass goes to zero, order one differences remain, as this extra scalar degree of freedom actually changes the coefficient from a half to a third. Now, it was initially thought that this ruled out massive gravity altogether, as clearly order one differences were ruled out by solar system observations. But that's not the complete story. So a fellow named Weinstein showed that the scalar mode exhibits strong self-coupling, which leads to non-linearities below some source-dependent scale called the Weinstein radius. Now these non-linearities save the theory, because roughly speaking, near the Weinstein radius, quadratic terms in your metric fluctuations become of the same order as linear terms, and so we need a new perturbation scheme. Now, with this new perturbation scheme, agreement is restored with the GR in the limit that the mass goes to zero. And now, as I mentioned, these general models that we're considering also exhibit strong self-coupling of chi below some source-dependent scale, denoted R star, which is given in terms of alpha and your crossover scale, and the Schwarzschild radius of a source. And a similar screening mechanism restores agreement with GR, the limit that the crossover scale goes to. But actually, I forgot to mention, if you look here, the nature of this parameterization is such that alpha equals zero corresponds to massive gravity. Just pure massive gravity. And then, we can see that we can make a rough identification between the graviton mass and the inverse of the crossover scale. Okay, so to summarize these points, given some spherically symmetric source, a star, a planet, we have three regimes. Within our star, gravity is Einstein with small corrections, and it's these small corrections that we're going to calculate. Outside our star, but within the crossover scale, gravity looks like a Brzezinski scalar tensor theory. And so it displays order one deviations from GR. And past the crossover scale, gravity weakens considerably. So we're really going to be exploring this first week. So I'd just like to give some explicit examples of IR modified theories of gravity. So really the seminal example of IR modification in an attempt to solve the problem of cosmic acceleration is the Grain-Rolle model of Dvalli, Gavrilovsky, and Ferrati. In this model, our universe is a hypersurface embedded within a 5D Minkowski spacetime. And then the gravitational potential goes like a 4-dimensional 1 over r potential to a 5-dimensional 1 over r squared potential past some crossover scale. Now this model generated excitement as it produced a De Sitter solution without the need for any dark energy or a cosmological constant. But it didn't solve the cosmological constant problem as much as ignore, because there was no cosmological constant. So in the context of these theories, DGP corresponds to alpha equals a half. Now there have been higher dimensional extensions of DGP, namely the cascading gravity models introduced by Claudia, Andrew, Tully, and others. And in these models, basically our universe is just a brain that's embedded within a brain that can be embedded within a brain, and so on. And the gravitational potential similarly goes like 1 over r to 1 over r squared to 1 over r cubed at ever-increasing distances. Now, cascading gravity is not exactly in the class of models we're considering, but the mass function, or the equivalent, corresponds to a slowly function or is a slowly growing function of box, so that corresponds to alpha close to zero. So we can still use this theory to potentially constrain cascading gravity models. Now, these models are promising, as it's been demonstrated that one can place a large cosmological constant on the brain without having it undergo accelerated expansion. So this is one model that can possibly realize this idea of degravitation, whereby we ask, can we find a mechanism by which an arbitrarily large cosmological constant can gravitate as weakly as needed to explain the observed cosmic acceleration? We know that in all of these models, gravity weakens past some cosmologically large crossover scale. So the question really becomes, does it become weak enough? Now, it turns out that any model that can potentially degravitate a cosmological constant is equivalent to a model with a massive or resonance graviton with alpha between 0 and strictly less than half. So I'll just make a note of that. For degravitation, potential degravitation, we need alpha strictly less than a half, which rules out DGP as a potential degravitator. Now, it's been demonstrated that one can recover a solution that tends to flat space in the presence of a large cosmological constant at the linear level, but that's not really enough, as we really want to reproduce a de Sitter solution at the nonlinear level with small scalar curvature corresponding to small acceleration. But it's not known how the full idea will be implemented, or even whether any sensible nonlinear theories exist in this allowed range. Nevertheless, the prospect is intriguing, so it's worth studying these problems. Okay, so on to extracting predictions from these models. So, as it stands, the theory is difficult to calculate with, as the dynamics of the helicity 2 modes and helicity 0 modes are coupled. So, we're going to be working in a certain decoupling limit, which is valid when metric fluctuations are small, whereby we have decoupled equations of motion for these different modes. So, what I mean by this is that we can write our metric fluctuations in terms of the Einstein piece, the helicity 2 piece, and the chi piece. And then these satisfy this satisfies the usual linearized Einstein field equations. That's the Planck mass. And chi satisfies this equation.
This is entering Bruce's bell. How did that happen?
So even in the decoupling limit, it's hard to calculate. Now, up until now, we've been ignoring the helicity 1 vector modes, but it doesn't matter because in this decoupling limit, they completely decouple from the source. So, like I said, we only need to worry about the dynamics of this kind. So now the name of the game is just choose your favorite source. And
so just to probe that a little bit, you say decouple, but presumably in the solar system, we would measure them, or by decoupling, you really mean something more. That they're unobservable? Is that what you mean? Or is it simply they don't affect the evolution of the normal kind of modes?
Yeah, that's the second part.
So
the dynamics doesn't come in.
So do the vector modes just satisfy some kind of sourceless wave type?
Well, I've actually never seen anything, any equation that big satisfy.
Okay.
Just
yes.
I've just seen them.
Okay. So they just kind of buzz around and not really doing anything.
Right, so spectrum is in general decay with ecological expansion. So even if they have started out, there are known sources, but the presumption is that there was, if they started out unsourced, no matter if they started excited, they would have been long ago decaying.
At the linear level, right?
This is all. Even the linear level is not enough that this decoupling. The technical details of the decoupling get a little involved, but basically when we have small metric fluctuations, we can work in this sensible limit whereby this happens, the helicity one modes go away.
I guess I'm jumping to the case of, you mentioned a star, and so where you're sort of in the nonlinear gravity regime, perhaps. So like, maybe, are you thinking binary pulsar as a potential test? You see, you've got anomalous Pleiadian precession. So there you're thinking solar system. Okay, so then,
So normally in general relativity, you also find that you do have scalar and vector perturbations. So is this H mu nu kind of on top of those? In GR, this is just the thing that's usually a spin 2 part, but it's got a section of it. So the other bits are there too, right? Like the Newtonian potentials. So the metric isn't eta mu nu plus h mu nu.
Okay. The whole metric is the eta mu nu plus small perturbations.
Which point to the h, which you add eta mu nu to get g mu nu?
The full h.
Good. Okay, but shouldn't there be like a phi, which is proportional to the...
That's in the... time.
Right.
That's
the
answer.
Oh,
okay, sorry, I
thought the answer. So this, everything
you still have your Newtonian potential, and I asked a conditional potential. Sorry, I just
thought the Einstein one was just
the spin 2.
Oh, no. Sorry. So the Einstein half will have vectors in it as well.
They're non-propagating. So the difference is that these are propagating, but these are potentially propagating. It's not very well explored question of whether they could do something, but the presumption is that they won't.
Right. So we want to solve this for our favorite source. And of course our favorite source is the sun or the earth. Basically, we're interested in solar system dynamics. So we're going to choose, what we want to see what chi looks like near the sun or the earth. So we take for our stress energy one for a point source. And we find that for r much less than r within r star, chi looks like this. With some numerical prefactor. That's not really important. So what can we do with this? As you know, one of the first great successes of GR was in predicting the precession of Mercury's perihelion. And now with this chi present, gravity at the shortest scale, small scales, is actually stronger, and so there's an additional advance of the perihelion. Now, normally the advance of the perihelion is given by some horrendous integral. But it turns out that you can get a more simple expression for the advance per orbit in terms of the fractional change in potential. So if we know how chi comes in, then we can get the precession the perihelion advance per orbit in terms of alpha and your crossover scale, and through data from laser ranging experiments in the solar system, we can constrain the R scale parameter space. So just the expression delta phi in its full glory looks like this. Again, this is just some number that we calculated. And so we see we have the advance per orbit in terms of alpha and our star, but actually our star is given in terms of the crossover scale, so we have what we want. Okay, so I'll just show you the plot that comes out of this. So here we have what I just described, the alpha, the bottom axis is alpha, you have the crossover scale, the y-axis, you see that, okay, so, so to explain the observed cosmic acceleration now, we really need, or we don't want the crossover scale to be any larger than the Hubble radius. We really want it to be of the same order. So imposing this condition, we see that this rules out models with alpha greater than 0.55. Now these curves represent lower limits on the crossover scale as better data, more tightly constrained delta phi is, the more this graph gets pushed up.
Is this a precession of Mars about the Sun?
Yeah, so this is the precession of this, Mars about the Sun, and this is the movement up here.
And Mercury?
Is Mercury much weaker constraints?
I didn't find any number I could use for Mercury.
Yeah, I think basically Mercury is just it's too big. They can get such precise numbers for using moon, even with the Mercury optics. Stronger filters and measure these all.
Okay.
Well, it's an interesting question of why Mars is better than the moon. It seems like, I guess because the sun is bigger than the moon.
I mean, you said you couldn't find data from Mercury.
Well,
that can't be right.
Well, I
in a sense.
I'm
sure you didn't find them. I'm not saying you lied. there really is data out there.
I'm sure there is. This was more accessible. Yes. And also, I think we just have better data in general because on the moon we have mirrors, Mars has presumably has mirrors as well. We can use very precise laser ranging experiments. I don't think Mercury has.
I don't think Mars has mirrors.
No, I don't think Mars has mirrors. It's big.
The thing is, the perihelion for Mercury is much bigger. So the interesting question is, can I think of this as a multiplicative factor in some sense times the usual GR result?
No, it comes in. You have the GR result plus the extra result. This really is the anomalous precession.
I should have
made that more clear. This is really on top of GR, what we'd expect on top of GR.
Would one be smaller if they're smaller around? Is that right?
This isn't really. It's not clear how far outside our star you can carry this expression. But at least within our star, it does increase as you go.
Maybe you can remind everyone how our star depends on the mass of the Earth.
Okay.
Do you all remember the equation for our star?
So our star, right? Our star, phi minus 4 alpha, is this. But I think the problem is, like, are you guys worrying that it's potentially unbounded as you move?
Well, no, it's just my, I guess what Tom is saying is that Mars is further away than Mercury, so that might explain why Mars would give you a bigger constraint if it grows with R. And I guess that does make sense.
Do you know if RC is related to H naught to 9 as well, and RS is just a Schwarzschild radius of the sun?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what kind of value RS is?
Yeah, like for the sun, I think it's 120 parsecs.
Okay,
sun.
Wow. Wow, so it's,
yeah. Well, looking at the planets for
safe.
For reasonable values of RC, this limit is valid. Everything is valid.
Okay.
So it's, I guess, it's not clear how far out we can extend that far.
So highly eccentric orbits might give you a really nice taste, because the comet spends, you know, for example, comets spend a lot of time a long way away from the sun, then comes close. So you would expect to see a very large effect, perhaps.
Yeah.
So that might, Halley or something might be useful.
So we didn't really, this expression is valid for Halley circular orbits, but we don't really know what the corresponding expression would look like for when the eccentricity is important. Because this formula is basically just like the simplest term in the experiment. So,
so
I don't know how the eccentricity would happen.
So it kind of goes either side of our during the course of the solar, just by a small amount.
Right, so okay, as I said, models with alpha greater than 0.55 are ruled out, but that's not so bad because that leaves degravitating models still potentially stay correspond to alpha less. And then, as I said, cascading gravity corresponds to the alpha close to zero regime. Exactly, but the data is still valid there. Now, small corrections after this plot were made, actually pushed these limits a little bit lower. So really the best bound we have from Mars is about 10 to the negative 4 megaparsecs. But for this sector, the angle is the same. But roughly that's what we're looking at.
Which to emphasize means that that's a really weak constraint. That's like A.
It's okay. Okay, so just before moving on, I'd just like to emphasize how really convenient this approach is. Because we know solar system physics very well, and we have excellent data from within the solar system. For example, the latest lunar laser ranging project, Apollo, will, so they say, be able to determine the position of the moon to within 1 millimeter accuracy. So that should improve the bounds by a factor of 10. So, we definitely don't have this kind of data on cosmic scales, say structure formation or something. So it's really convenient that we can use simple solar system physics and tests to potentially rule out cosmological models. So, I like that.
Do you really believe that though, or is it just that artifact of the model for the mass term that you took such a simple parameterization?
Mm-hmm.
That the large scale and the small scale behavior of that mass term is controlled by a single number. So making observations on small scales gives you constraints at all. But presumably, let's say all of these models are ruled out, you just say, oh, okay, well, we need a more complicated mass term, perhaps. Or is that unfair?
I'm not sure about the details of the mass term. Basically, that parameterization was chosen. The simplest way we could modify the equations of motion. That's it. So I guess you consider more complicated mass functions. guys start something.
So do you know some of these kind of explicit models of cascading gravity actually give you a form of the how the mass varies?
Yeah, I think I've seen the mass function looks like the logarithmic function of us or arctan.
Is that something geometrical?
It comes from the matching. It comes from the Israel matching conditions, matching the basically gravity on the 4, 5, and 6 dimensional gravity. So it's probably the same geometrical conditions. So it's some angular matching between number one brain ends, and basically to pick up matching curvature across the band. So that's probably what we're thinking. But it's worth saying that in the DGT, which is the one that's under the best control, the form of the mass function and the equation which is protected by a unique symmetry, the Galilean symmetry, which picks out that mass, which essentially is what links this large scale small scale stuff and protects you from all kinds of trouble.
Mm.
So that's really what got people excited about. So this I don't think this equation which manifests that symmetry in the obvious way, but it could be this is a we don't really understand this equation motion at all. To be honest, I mean, Adam has done a good job of understanding it as well as we can, but I think that the suspicion is that this is, if it's describing something real, there's an extra degree of freedom that's been integrated out to get there. So if there's a symmetry there, it's going to be really hard to see.
Yeah, I once just tried to see what the Galilean shift, where just the derivative gets shifted by some constant factor, and this equation doesn't sound like it breaks rather badly, actually. Okay. Right, so as Mark mentioned, the observations rule out a rather large sector of the parameter space quickly, but say essentially nothing about these alpha close to zero sector. I mean, the constraints are so porous, it's almost uncomfortable. It's really necessary that we look to other observations that could potentially constrain this model. So what other possible observations are there? Well, we've been investigating what kind of features Chi would bring into galaxy rotation curves, but the mathematics thus far has been rather intractable. So I have nothing else to say about that except that galaxy dynamics in general provide a good probe of this kind of theory, because discrepancies between the lensing mass inferred from gravitational lensing, the determination of which has nothing to do with Chi, or is not affected by Chi, and the dynamical mass determined from the orbits of stars and gas within the galaxy, which clearly is affected by the presence of Chi, can give immediate indications of any deviations from gravity as we know it. And then, as you alluded to, actually, we can try to determine how much energy and gravitational radiation would be emitted by a typical binary pulsar system with Chi present, and compare this to the data we have on such systems. Now, that analysis would obviously be much more complicated because we don't know if the decoupling limit holds, or, I mean, some strong gravitational fields we're considering in that case. But it's a possibility that's been considered. And as far as theoretical issues go, it'd really be nice to know the nonlinear completions of these theories, or whether even such nonlinear completions exist. Because I mentioned there's no known nonlinear completion of pure mass of gravity, so we really don't know about the rest of the sector theory. And it'd also be particularly useful to get a modified Friedmann equation proper, so we could make cosmological predictions and then compare these to cosmic scale physics. Right, so just to wrap things up, I've shown how we can say a lot about a large class of but a large class of models that have a hope of solving the cosmological constant problem. At least at the linear level, these models can be parameterized with just two numbers, the crossover scale and alpha, denoting the form of the functional form of the modification. And we can make predictions with the theory that can already be compared with observations, and the parameter space of the theory can be constrained. So the models that can potentially degravitate the cosmological constant are safe and rather poorly constrained, but future work should serve to constrain these models much better.
Isn't it a simple intuitive way to understand why the models that work the best in terms of deep gravity are also the ones that are most protected in this to this are the ones where it's hardest to see the effect. Usually nature's not kind like that.
I don't know of any intuitive way to see that. The fact that alpha has to be less than a half just kind of falls out of a simple calculation. And I mean, the fact that they're so poor, the models with small alpha are so poorly constrained seems to be just a feature of the expression 4.5. You know, the intuitive reason why they should be protected any better.
Is it because our star gets bigger as alpha goes to zero? Is that a correct statement? So you're pushing the effect, the radius, I presume R star is the radius at which things really start to go crazy. So if you push that very far away while keeping the size of the solar system fixed, then of course you're actually diminishing the effects. I'm not sure if that's actually true from that relation.
Yeah, because my alpha is zero and you're taking a small.
So it might be that you actually want to look for at the asteroid belt or something. I don't know to what extent those things have been constrained. I guess there's a lot of recent work kind of looking at asteroids.
Can the Chi field propagate faster than the speed of light?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
It's just a typical equation here.
This has been studied by other people, but in the GGP case, the only one who can do really rigorous calculations in is this alpha equals a half, the GGP thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there, if you expand around non-trivial, like if you have if you expand around flat space, you're okay. But if you take a spherically symmetric space and expand around that, then you see that the perturbations do in fact propagate.
Do you ever have to worry about sort of gravitational Cherenkov radiation if the speed is slower than light? If it can be slower than light, and then if you have a cosmic ray.
Yeah, it's a good question. So there are some people who have thought about this to some extent. The effects are pretty tiny because they're related to the mass of graviton. But yeah, but you can get. These things happen. So you can get some kind of effect like that. But basically, you shouldn't be. It's not. It's unsurprising that the 4D effective speed of light for Earth propagation speed for these perturbations is not constrained to be one because they're really five or six dimensional perturbations. So the propagation into 4D of six dimensional phenomena. Any other questions? All right, well, let's think about it.